All right, well, let's open up to Genesis chapter 37 this evening. Genesis chapter 37, as we continue in our study in this great book of Genesis. And we come really tonight, as we come to the 37th chapter, we come to the final division of the book of Genesis. And perhaps you remember that in the early stages of our study, I told you that the book of Genesis was divided up by four great events and then divided up around the lives of four great men. So you remember those four great events. Of course, creation was the initial event. We spent a lot of time looking at the subject of creation. But then after creation, the fall occurred. And we spent some time looking at the fall and sin entering into the world. And then, of course, the next great event would have been the flood. And we considered at length the flood. And then the fourth and final event would be the dispersion that took place at Babylon when God confused the languages and dispersed men all over the world. And then we moved into the first of those four great men and studied the life of Abraham together. And then from Abraham, we looked at the life of Isaac. We've been studying the life of Jacob. And Jacob's life is still going to be interspersed in the final portion of Genesis here. But the primary focus now at this point is going to shift to Joseph. And it's interesting that it shifts to Joseph because when it comes to the covenant went from Abraham to Isaac, then to Jacob, and actually it will ultimately, the messianic element of it will ultimately pass to Judah. And we'll look at Judah tonight as well. But Joseph, although he's not in that lineage that will ultimately lead to the Messiah, he was a key person in the events that God used to bring Israel into that place of being a nation. And although Joseph isn't in the lineage of Christ, he is very much a type of Christ. And at some point, as we look at his life, we're going to look at the parallels between Joseph and Jesus. They're fascinating to see how similar their lives were and experiences. And again, no doubt Joseph was a type of Christ. If you were to put a theme over the life of Joseph, Romans 8:28. I think would really be an accurate theme for the life of Joseph. You know that verse, I think, we're familiar with it. All things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are the called according to his purpose. And that verse is so incredibly illustrated in the life of Joseph. And so as we look at the life of this young man, we're going to see that he experiences a lot of difficulty, a lot of hardship, a lot of things that were completely beyond his ability to really grasp or understand at the time that he was going through them. But we're going to find that God was working out this great purpose that Joseph couldn't necessarily see as he was going through the process. But it all comes out in the end, and we see how wonderfully God turns the evil intentions of men into something glorious and actually a fulfillment of his ultimate purpose. One of the commentators that I've been reading as I've been studying through Genesis, a man named James Montgomery Boyce, he stated this about Joseph, and I think it's excellent. He said, "Joseph is truly a remarkable man. He was loved and hated, favored and abused, tempted and tried, abased and exalted. Yet at no point in the 110-year life of Joseph did he ever seem to get his eyes off God or cease to trust him. Adversity did not harden his character. Prosperity did not ruin him. He was the same in private and public. He was truly a great man. And he was. And so as we go into the details of his life, we're going to see all of these things spelled out. So as we begin in chapter 37, we get an introduction to the life of Joseph. And then in chapter 38, we jump over to look briefly at another one of the sons of Jacob. We look briefly at the life of Judah. So it's almost like we get, you know, sort of a teaser. We get this introduction into the life of Joseph, and we see immediately the drama unfolds, and then we're sort of put on pause, and we go and deal with Judah a little bit. But then in chapter 39, we pick up full swing with the story of Joseph. So tonight, hopefully, we can get through chapters 37 and 38. So, chapter 37, verse 1. Now Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. This is the history of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers, and the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and with the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. Now Israel, who of course is Jacob, now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age. You know, it's interesting. I did the calculation on this today. Jacob was about 90 years old when Joseph was born. And so he was indeed the son of his old age. And it says also he made him a tunic of many colors. So Jacob was unashamedly giving preferential treatment to Joseph, which didn't really help for good relations in the family. And, you know, didn't really make things any easier for Joseph himself, because his brothers greatly envied him. So Jacob not only, you know, gives him preferential treatment, but he gives him this coat. And we read here that it was a coat of many colors. There's a lot of different proposed translations of this Hebrew phrase. Some say it was a coat with long sleeves and kind of more like a robe. Some say, well, no, it was a coat with ornaments on it. It was evidently an ostentatious kind of a garment that indicated itself that he was the preferred child. And so, you know, Joseph is young, he's 17. Who knows? I mean, maybe this did go to his head a little bit. Maybe he did sort of, you know, flash that coat around just to be an irritation to his older brothers. We don't know exactly what the case was, but we do know that they were not happy with Joseph. So, but when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. Now Joseph had a dream, and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. So he said to them, "Please hear this dream which I have dreamed. There we were binding sheaves in the field. Then behold, my sheaf arose and also stood upright, and indeed your sheaf stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf." And his brother said to him, "Shall you indeed reign over us? Or shall you indeed have dominion over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Now, I don't know if it was the best idea for Joseph to tell them about the dream, or, you know, maybe in the tone of voice that he communicated it in. Obviously, it got them more upset. But it's interesting that these were not just the vain imaginations of a spoiled teenager. These were revelations that were coming to Joseph from God himself. And what he dreamed was actually a prophetic dream of what would happen in the future. So, verse 9, then he dreamed still another dream and told it to his brothers and said, look, I have dreamed another dream, and this time the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to me. So he told it to his father and his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said to him, what is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come and bow down to the earth before you? So now Jacob is a bit bothered by the dream. And notice, Jacob sort of interprets, really, the dream to some extent. Joseph, he dreamed that the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to him. Jacob sort of interpreted that to be referring to himself and to his wife and to his other sons. Now, some argue, based on the statement of Jacob here, that this probably occurred not in the chronological order. It probably occurred back before Rachel died, because there's a reference to Joseph's mother. Others say, well, no, you know, Leah would have stepped in as sort of the stepmother, who was also Joseph's aunt. We don't really know. It's not really that important. But on just a bit of a side note, this interpretation by Jacob helps us to understand another difficult portion of Scripture. And we see from this passage here in Genesis 37, we see this principle of how the Bible interprets itself. Now, over in Revelation chapter 12, verse 1, if you want to just flip over there real quickly, we read this in verse 1. Now, a great sign appeared in heaven. A woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a garland of 12 stars. And then down at verse 5, she bore a male child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron, and her child was caught up to God and to his throne. Now, a question that's often asked is, who is the woman in Revelation chapter 12? And the Catholic Church, of course, has stated and believed for centuries that this is speaking of Mary. And when I was a boy, when I was attending the masses, I remember oftentimes as you would walk into a Catholic church, there was a picture, or not a picture, there was actually a statue of Mary, who was there, standing on the sun or the moon and the 12 stars. And so this imagery to Roman Catholics speaks very definitely concerning Mary. But if you use the Bible to interpret the Bible, it's not Mary that's being referred to here, but it's rather Israel. And Jacob is the one who gives us that interpretation, because Joseph has the same exact imagery that's here in Revelation chapter 12, verse 1, in his dream. The sun, the moon, and the 11 stars. Now, there's one other star added here because, of course, it would have been Joseph as well. But the fact that this isn't Mary is not only based on what we read there in Genesis chapter 37, but when you go on and just continue to read into verse 6, then the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God that they should feed her there 1,260 days. So, of course, none of those kinds of things happened in the life of Mary. This is a prophecy about something that's going to happen in the future. It's going to happen with the same woman that's being referred to in chapter 12, verse 1. And the answer to the mystery here is that according to Jacob, the woman is Israel, the nation of Israel, and that fits with the context there as well. So just a little side note on using the Bible to interpret the Bible. That's the best way to interpret Scripture, is to look for the answer some other place in Scripture. So Jacob rebukes Joseph, but look what it says in verse 11. In verse 11 it says, "And his brothers envied him, but his father kept the matter in mind." So Jacob obviously sensed that there might be something to these dreams. He loved Joseph. He knew that Joseph, out of all of his sons, was the one who had integrity. And as we go on in the story here, and as we look at the next chapter, we're going to see that Jacob's sons were basically just a bunch of evil guys, for the most part. They will have a change of heart later in life, but at this stage in their life, they were essentially evil and had no real, you know, commitment to God or any real love for God that was noticeable anyway. But Joseph was the one that stood out. Joseph had a genuine love for God. And perhaps with Jacob, it wasn't just that he preferred him because he was his, the son of his old age. But perhaps he sensed in Joseph that there was that spirituality. There was that that commitment to God that he himself had. And so verse 12, "Then his brothers went to feed their father's sheep in Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, 'Are not your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem? Come and I will send you to them.' So he said to him, 'Here I am.' And then he said to him, 'Please go and see if it is well with your brothers and well with the flocks, and bring back word to me.' So he sent him out of the valley of Hebron, and he went to Shechem. Now a certain man found him, and there he was wandering in the field. And the man asked him, saying, 'What are you seeking?' So he said, 'I am seeking my brothers. Please tell me where they are feeding the flocks.' And the man said, 'They have departed from here, and for I heard them say, let us go to Dothan.'" So if you look at a map, they were dwelling in Hebron. They went up north to Shechem and then just over slightly west to the area of Dothan there. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them in Dothan. Now when they saw him afar off, even before he came near, they conspired against him to kill him." Now, this is what I mean. These guys were evil guys. They weren't just angry with him. They weren't just upset at him. It wasn't like, "Hey, here comes Joseph. Let's rough him up a little bit. You know, let's get his coat dirty, or let's, trip him, or let's, have a little bit of fun with him." No, here comes our brother. Let's kill him. That's how envious and full of hatred these guys were toward their own flesh and blood, toward their own younger brother. And so they said to one another, "Look, this dreamer is coming. Come, therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say some wild beast has devoured him. We shall see what will become of his dreams then." But Reuben heard it. Now, Reuben is the oldest brother. So Reuben overheard it, and he delivered him out of their hands, and he said, "Let us not kill him." And Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood, but cast him into this pit, which is in the wilderness, and do not lay a hand on him." Reuben said this that he might come back later and deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father. Now, not that Reuben was necessarily an upright guy, but Reuben had already gotten into big trouble with his father because he had taken one of Jacob's concubines and had relations with her, and that was obviously a very bad thing. So Reuben was in trouble. Reuben was the firstborn. He was the oldest. So anything that happened to Joseph while Reuben was around, the brunt of it probably would have come back on him. So to a certain extent, Reuben is just looking to save his own neck rather than having any, real great concern for Joseph. So it came to pass, when Joseph had come to his brothers, that they stripped him of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him. Then they took him and cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty. There was no water in it. So it was probably a cistern, a waterless cistern that they put him in. But notice they stripped him of his tunic, the very thing that indicated Jacob's love for him. They stripped him of that, and they cast him into this pit. And look at verse 25, and they sat down to eat a meal. Heartless guys sat down to eat a meal. And no doubt Joseph was not too far away, probably crying out, probably pleading with them, probably saying, come on, you guys, you know, let me out of this thing. And they turn a deaf ear to him. They just sit down and have a meal. Then they lifted their eyes and looked, and there was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing spices, balm and myrrh, on their way to carry them down to Egypt. So Judah speaks up. He gets involved. He said to his brothers, what profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother in our flesh. And his brothers listened. Then Midianite traders passed by, so the brothers pulled Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt. So let's not kill him, we'll just sell him. The Ishmaelites and the Midianites, these are evidently synonymous. Of course, remember, Ishmael was a relative. Ishmael was the son of Abraham. So it's interesting that this band of probably a nomadic group, they were sort of distant relatives. But here's this boy now, 17 years of age, and he is sold into slavery, and he's carried off to Egypt. Then Reuben returned to the pit, and indeed Joseph was not in the pit, and he tore his clothes, and he returned to his brothers and said, the lad is no more, and I, where shall I go? So Reuben realizes that he is going to have to face his father. And he returned to, verse 31. So they took Joseph's tunic, killed a kid of the goats, and dipped the tunic in the blood. Then they sent the tunic of many colors, and they brought it to their father and said, we have found this. Do you know whether it is your son's tunic or not? And he recognized it and said, it is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Without doubt, Joseph is torn to pieces. Then Jacob tore his clothes, put on sackcloth on his waist, and mourned for his son many days. So again, we see the heartlessness of the brothers. They lie to their father. It's Jacob is heart sick. He's devastated by this. But they carry on with their deception. But it is interesting. Notice that it was the blood of a young goat that they used to deceive Jacob with. And remember back when Jacob deceived his father those many years earlier, remember how it was goat's skin and wool that he placed upon his body to appear to be Esau, who was a hairy man. And remember, as Isaac rubbed his arm and he felt the goat's hair, he said, well, the voice is Jacob's, but the skin is Esau's. And so Jacob deceived Isaac with a goat, and now the sons of Jacob are deceiving him with the blood of a goat. And all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted, and he said, for I shall go down into the grave to my son in mourning. Thus his father wept for him. Now the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and captain of the guard. So Joseph is now a slave in Egypt. At 17 years old, he's ripped out of his home, taken away from his family, betrayed by his own brothers, and now at this tender age, he finds himself in this situation there. And we'll pick up Joseph's story, as I said, in chapter 39. But just to get kind of a personal view of the character of some of the men that sold him, the story now turns to Judah. And Judah, you remember, was the one that suggested that Joseph be sold to the Ishmaelites. And we're going to see that all of these brothers of Joseph's were men of dubious character. And so it came to pass at that time that Judah departed from his brothers and visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. And Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he married her and went into her. So she conceived and bore a son and called his name Ur. She conceived again and bore a son and called his name Onan. She conceived yet again and bore a son and called his name Shelah. He was at Chezeb when she bore him. Then Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord killed him. Interesting. And Judah said to Onan, go into your brother's wife and marry her and raise up an heir to your brother. But Onan knew that the heir would not be his. And it came to pass when he went into his brother's wife that he emitted on the ground lest he should give an heir to his brother. And the thing which he did displeased the Lord. Therefore, he killed him also. So, wow, we have two men in the family, this, you know, chosen family, sons of Judah, but they were wicked and the Lord slew them. Now, what do we make of that? Does that happen today? It doesn't happen today. It happened then because remember, these people were in this very tight covenant relationship with God, and God's dealings with them were very strict in relation to the covenant. Now, Judah, even though at this point it doesn't appear that that it would be the case, Judah is going to be the one through whom the Messiah is going to come. Remember, Jesus is referred to in Revelation chapter 5 as the Lion of the tribe of Judah. And of course, David came from Judah. But these sons of Judah, Er, who was his firstborn, who would have been the heir, was a wicked man. So he's not going to be able to be the ancestor of the Messiah. And because of his wickedness, whatever it was, God slew him. And then Onan was obviously a selfish man because he wouldn't raise up, which was the obligation of the brother to raise up a child for his dead brother. And rather than, you know, going ahead and impregnating Tamar, he, as it says, emitted on the ground. And because of that act, because of his refusal to raise up, because of his selfishness, God slew him for that as well. Now, as we go on, it says, then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow in your father's house till my son Shelah is grown. For he said, lest he also die like his brothers. And Tamar went and dwelt in her father's house. So Judah sets her aside. He's not about to give his third son. He's already lost two in regard to Tamar. So he says, I'm not, you know, Shelah was too young at this point, but he says, you know, let's wait till he grows up and then he can be your husband. So Tamar submitted to that. She didn't have much choice, really. Now, in the process of time, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, died. And this is the mother of these three sons. We don't know her name. And Judah was comforted and went up to his sheep herders, or sheep shearers, at Timnah, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. And it was told Tamar, so now many years have passed, it was told Tamar, saying, "Look, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep." So he took, or she took off her widow's garments, covered herself with a veil, and wrapped herself, and sat in an open place which was on the way to Timnah, for she saw that Shelah was grown, and she was not given to him as a wife. So, in other words, Judah reneged on his promise, and now he's got Tamar in a perpetual state of, limbo. She can't, he's not going to give Shelah to marry her. He's not giving her freedom to go and resume a life, you know, with another possibility. So she's in this predicament here where Judah is dealing falsely with her. And so, verse 15, when Judah saw her, he thought she was a harlot, because she had covered her face. Then he turned to her by the way and said, "Please let me come in to you," for he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. So she said, "What will you give me that you may come in to me?" So we see that, you know, these are problemed people, as I think you will agree. One is pretending to be a prostitute, the other is soliciting a prostitute. And these are people that are part of the chosen family. I mean, you know, this is a problem. But, you know, God's had to work historically with sinners. That's what he's got. And it is interesting, though, that in the genealogy of Jesus in Matthew chapter 1, there are four women mentioned in that genealogy. And interestingly, every one of them would be really marked as sinners. There's Tamar, she's the first one mentioned. Then there's Rahab, whom we know from Joshua was a harlot. And then there's Ruth. Now, Ruth is the only one that wouldn't have, that kind of a spot or stain upon her. She was a woman of godly character, but she was a Moabite, so she was outside of the covenant. And then also, finally, Bathsheba. So interesting that out of all of the names in the genealogy, only four women are listed, and those are the four women. Tamar is the first one. And, of course, there's a list of dozens of men. And as you look at the genealogies of Jesus, what you realize, again, is the Lord came into the world to save sinners, because the people who brought him into the world were themselves sinners as well. And so we see that very clearly here as we look at this. So he turns aside, you know, "Let me come into you." So she said, "What will you give me that you may come into me?" And he said, "I will send a young goat from the flock." So she said, "Will you give me a pledge till you send it?" Then he said, "What pledge shall I give you?" So she said, "Your signet and cord and your staff that is in your hand." Then he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. So she arose and went away and laid aside her veil and put on the garments of her widowhood. And Judah sent the young goat by the hand of his friend Adullam to receive his pledge from the woman's hand, but he did not find her. Then he asked the men of the place, saying, "Where is the harlot who was openly by the roadside?" And they said, "There was no harlot in this place." So he returned to Judah and said, "I cannot find her." Also, the men of the place said, "There was no harlot in this place." Then Judah said, "Let her take them for herself, lest we be ashamed, for I sent the young goat and you have not found her." And it came to pass about 3 months later, Judah was told, saying, "Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has played the harlot Furthermore, she is with child by harlotry. So Judah said, listen to this, bring her out and let her be burned. So, man, look at the ruthlessness here. Now, he hears that Tamar has played the harlot. She's to be burned. What about him soliciting a harlot? You see the double standard that, you know, has historically been there, even to this very day. You know, there seems to be a double standard between what men are allowed to do and what women are allowed to do in this particular area. You know, for a man to go out on his wife, oh, well, you know, that's something to boast about. For a woman to go out on her husband, oh, that's a dreadful and shameful thing. Of course, both of them are dreadful and shameful. But again, we just see that this double standard isn't anything new. It's been around from the early days of human history. So Judah wants to have her burned. And when she was brought out, she sent to her father-in-law saying, by the man to whom these belong, I am with child. And she said, please determine whose these are, the signet and cord and staff. Ooh, Judah was busted big time. So Judah acknowledged them and said, she has been more righteous than I, because I did not give her to Shelah my son, and he never knew her again. So it was wrong what Tamar did. It was akin to what we've seen happening in the lives of others previously. Not trusting God, but instead taking matters into her own hands and trying to, you know, vindicate herself rather than trusting the Lord, waiting upon the Lord. You see, she's going to have two sons, as we're going to read in a moment. And Perez is going to be the one through whom the messianic line is going to carry on. So, of course, this all already had to happen before the world was ever created. And you can be sure that God had a way to accomplish it where he didn't need people to revert to sin and to scheming and plotting and deceiving to get it all done. But again, this is so often what we revert to, even as God's people. When we're waiting and the Lord doesn't seem to be moving, he doesn't seem to be acting, the big temptation comes for us to jump in and try to make it happen ourselves. And this is we see this again over and over here as we go through the lives of these different people. And so, verse 27, now it came to pass at the time for giving birth, that behold, twins were in her womb. And so it was when she was giving birth that the one put out his hand, and the midwife took a scarlet thread and bound it on his hand, saying, this one came out first. Then it happened, as he drew back his hand, that his brother came out unexpectedly, and she said, how did you break through? This breach be upon you. Therefore his name was called Perez. Afterward his brother came out, who had the scarlet thread on his hand, and his name was called Zerah. And so Perez will be the one. As we look in the genealogies, Perez is the name that appears there. So chapter 38, I think, does a couple of things. It reveals to us, again, the character of these men that we're dealing with, the ones who sent Joseph into slavery. But it also shows how God overrules when men are not cooperating. God's plan is still going to be accomplished. And with Judah's unjust dealings with Tamar, God overrules in all of that, and he allows certain things to happen, and he providentially brings about his ultimate purpose through those things. And that's the thing that I want to move toward as we wrap things up this evening, talking for a few minutes about providence, the providence of God. Now, one commentator had this to say. I thought it was excellent. He said, it was God's intention already revealed to Abraham to bring the chosen family under foreign dominion until the iniquity of the Amorites should be full and Canaan ripe for possession. So the train of events to lead Israel into Egypt is set in motion through the rivalries and predicaments of the 12 brothers under the hand of God. The story is a classic example of divine providence. So when we talk about providence, what are we talking about? And that we use that term sometimes. Previous generations have used it sometimes more than we do. It's interesting, if you read in the writings of the founding fathers of this country, many of them were not Christians in the sense that we think of Christians, you know, biblical Christians, born-again Christians. They were believers in God. They were theists. And they spoke much about God's providential rule over things. And they believed that in God's providence, he had brought about the development or the birth of this nation. And so they would sometimes even substitute providence for God. Rather than use even a reference to God, they would just simply speak of providence. Providence means that continuous activity of God whereby he makes all the events of the physical, mental, and moral realms work out for his purpose. And this purpose is nothing short of the original design of God in creation. To be sure, evil has entered the universe, but it is not allowed to thwart God's original, benevolent, wise, and holy purpose. So you see, providence is God overruling all of men's plots and schemes and intentions, overruling even their evil activities to ultimately and finally bring about his will. And with Joseph, providence is seen amazingly in the life of Joseph. Because as we have seen, his brothers were evil men. His brothers hated him. All of their intentions toward him were purely evil. But God had a plan to save Israel from a famine that he knew was going to come. And he's going to save them by getting Joseph to Egypt. And so he allows his evil brothers to plot against him and to sell him into slavery. And he uses all of that to fulfill ultimately his purpose. And as we, I hate to jump to the end of the story, but we've got a ways to go to get through it. But at the end, when it's all finally said and done, and his brothers are petrified of Joseph finally, thinking, okay, now that our father is dead, he's going to kill us. He's going to take vengeance on us. He's going to pay us back for what we did to him all those years ago. And they come groveling before Joseph. Joseph says, look, am I in the place of God? He said, you did indeed intend it for evil, but God meant it for good. He said, I've got nothing. I will not extract any vengeance on you, because I realize that the hand of God was in it all. And so we see that providence with Joseph. We see later when we come to the New Testament in the book of Acts, Peter, you know, he says essentially the same thing in regard to Jesus when he's talking to the very men that crucified him. He said, you've taken by wicked hands, you've crucified and slain, but this all happened according to the determined purpose and foreknowledge of God. So you see, this is what providence is. God, he brings all of these circumstances together that seem unrelated or seem to not at all be able to fit into the plan, but he brings it all together to work out his glorious purposes. Now, to me, this is one of the mind-boggling things about God. You know, how he can do that is, that's part of the mystery of omniscience. I don't understand that. But that is certainly what the scriptures teach. Now, with providence, it's not just something that was experienced in the life of Joseph or in, you know, those that we're reading about here in the pages of scripture. It's something that we experience as well. It's something that occurs quite, I think, frequently in our lives. If you want a good study in the providence of God, pick up Pastor Chuck's new book, Memoirs of Grace, because to a large degree, that's what it is. And it's fascinating as you read through the story to see how over years and years, the Lord is moving Chuck and Kay to different places and connecting them with different people and then disconnecting them from those people and, you know, not really understanding, you know, why and what was happening and, you know, why they went in this direction versus that direction and why these people came and they were such great people, but then they ended up having to leave. And, you know, just kind of one story after another like that. But then you see there comes a point where the whole thing, all of these past relationships, all of this history, all of this moving around from different places to different churches, it all culminates in this work that God wants to do. And all of those people that were connected at one point but then seemed to become disconnected, they all get connected back together again in this great work that God determined to do. And when you look at this, you know, this move of the Spirit that we call the Jesus movement or, you know, the beginning of the Calvary Chapel ministry, you see that God's providence is all over it. And again, we see this in our lives. I think of some of my own experiences. I think of some of the people that I've met, you know, seemingly randomly over the years, and some of the people that I have ended up getting connected with, and even at times wondering, you know, why am I connected with this person, or what's the attraction to this person, or, you know, under certain circumstances I wouldn't even, you know, associate with this person. Not that they were a bad person or anything, but just, you know, it just wasn't the kind of person I would normally connect with, but I would find there was a strong connection. But then we would go our separate ways and end up doing different things. But lo and behold, at a certain point, all of a sudden, something happens, and those relationships and the significance of them, it all comes together, and boom, there we are. God's got us doing something. And I'll never forget a couple of things. When we went to one of the great things that I learned in London, I learned that when you're looking to establish a team of people to minister alongside of, the best thing to do is let God do it. I really did. I learned that. Because, you know, we kind of assembled a team, people that we liked, people that we felt connected with, people that we thought, well, this is going to be great. And, you know, we found that it just, you know, it didn't work. It worked previously under certain circumstances, but when we got into that particular one, It just didn't work. But then we found that the Lord actually would start bringing these other people, people from our past, people who we had met or connected with at other places. And then in the end, we ended up with, I looked around and thought, you know, this is the most unlikely team. I never would have assembled this team, but this is the right team. And you could see the providence of God. You could see the hand of God in it. I'll never forget one other story. A long time ago, I forgot how long ago, but I won't forget the event. It was a long time ago. Well, I think it was back in 1983. So how long ago was that? 26 years ago. 26 years ago, I was sitting right over there, and there was a pew there back then. And I had been teaching. I think it was a Monday night. I had been teaching. And there was a man who had been helping out in the ministry here at the time, and his name was Gaylord Tohill. And Cheryl and I had made a commitment. The Lord had called us to head down to Vista, North San Diego County, and to take up the ministry down there. And I had met Gaylord one time before. Him and his wife had come in for some brief counseling about something to do with their son. And I'd seen him around the church, but I hadn't really had any deep conversation with him. So on this final night, when I'm doing this Monday night Bible study, afterwards, I sit down over there, and Gaylord comes and he sits down. And for the next hour, I just tell him everything that God's doing in our lives, and how, you know, the Lord's sending us down to Vista. And so we finished our conversation, and he left, and Cheryl and I left, and we went home. We went home to pack. And I remember driving home, and I said to Cheryl, I go, you know, that was weird. Why did I tell that Gaylord guy all of that stuff? You know, it was just kind of strange. I just thought that was odd. But, you know, the next day, Gaylord showed up at my house and said, hey, could we help you guys pack? And we said, well, sure. Yeah, we could use the help. So they helped us pack. And then a few days later, hey, could we help you guys move? Well, sure. Yeah, you could help us move. We can use the help. And so they helped us move. And then we got down there and we took on the ministry at the church there. And then Gaylord said to me, hey, do you mind if we come down there on Sundays? And maybe I could just, you know, I could like clean the bathrooms, or I could just help out with the, you know, just some of the things. And I thought, well, you know, it's just Cheryl and I. We could use some help. That'd be nice. Sure, come on down. And so they started coming down on Sundays. And that happened for several months. And the funny thing about Gaylord was that he had been the vice president of a very successful company. He'd retired at the age, I think, of 34 or so. And he was basically floating around in the harbor on his boat, reading his Bible, saying, God, what do you want me to do with the rest of my life? And so, but they kept coming down and, you know, visiting and there on the weekends and helping out. And it was such a blessing. You know, we were young. I was 26 and Cheryl was 23. And we didn't know exactly what we were doing. And so, you know, they kept coming down weekend after weekend. And, you know, finally, I looked at Gaylord one day when we were working together side by side. And I said, you know, why don't you just be my assistant pastor? He said, well, okay. I said, well, you're kind of doing that already anyway, you know, but why don't you just come on and do it? And he said, okay, well, you know, we'll pray about it. And then, you know, they prayed about it, and they, you know, were living up here still. They were commuting back and forth, and we thought, oh, surely, you know, they'll get their house sold real quickly and get down. But that didn't happen. The house didn't sell for a long time, and they commuted down for the longest time. But just faithfully, every weekend there, every Wednesday there. And, you know, but I look back, my whole point is, I look back at that conversation that we had right there, and I realized that was providence. Because God was preparing not only me to go down there, God was preparing Gaylord to come alongside of me. I didn't even know it. And I didn't really even know him at the time. And at the time, I never would have even suggested such a thing. But just as I shared with him what was on my heart for the ministry down there, God touched his heart. And see, that's what happens. You never know. You never know. But you come in here on a Wednesday night. You come in here on a Sunday morning. You come on here Sunday night, whatever, Monday night, whatever. You come and you meet somebody and you strike up a conversation. You don't know what's going to happen. This could be the very relationship that's going to thrust you into some ministry, some thing that you've never even dreamed that you would be doing. But that's how God works providentially. And God providentially works to bring us together. Circumstances beyond our control that put us in the right place at the right time in the right relationships. That's providence. It was providence that I decided with a few friends to go to a Bible study on New Year's Day in 1980. When we didn't think that there was even a Bible study that we could go to, but we made a few phone calls. We found out there was a Bible study in Huntington Harbor, and we decided to go. And it was providence, because when I walked in that Bible study, a really pretty girl was walking out of it. And I saw her, and I thought, why is she leaving? I just got here. But she left. But you know, I remembered what she looked like. She was really cute. And 2 weeks later, when I went back to the Bible study, she was there again. And now she's my wife and has been for 29 years. But, you know, that was a providential encounter. And so, you see, these are the things. Not just in the life of Joseph. Not just with the Lord and God's great plan of salvation. But in our lives, personally, individually, God's hand working providentially. And this is part of the thrill, the excitement, the adventure of the Christian life, to just sort of stand back and see what the Lord will do. It's a great thing. It's a great life. So we'll get further into the life of Joseph in our next study.